Today is Wednesday, July the 31st, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The government's concern about your privacy. USPS, that's the U.S. Postal Service, shared customer postal addresses with Meta, LinkedIn, and Snap. The Postal Service took action to remediate the issue following a TechCrunch investigation. The U.S. Postal Service was sharing the postal addresses of its online customers with advertising and tech giants Meta, LinkedIn, and Snap. Last Wednesday, the USPS said it addressed the issue and stopped the practice, claiming that it was unaware of it. Well, how did it get started? TechCrunch found USPS was sharing customers' information by way of hidden data collecting code, also known as tracking pixels, used across its website. Tech and advertising companies created this kind of code to collect information about the user, such as which page they visit, every time a web page containing the code loads in the customer's browser. In the case of USPS, some of that collected data included the postal addresses of logged-in USPS informed delivery customers who use the service to see photos of their incoming mail before it arrives. It's not clear how many individuals had their information collected or for how long. Informed delivery had more than 62 million users as of March 2024. In a statement to TechCrunch, USPS spokesperson Jim McCain said the Postal Service leverages an analytics platform for our own internal purposes so that we understand the usage of our products and services and which we use on an aggregated basis to market our products. The Postal Service does not sell or provide any personal information that is collected from this analytics platform to any third party, and we were unaware of any configuration of the platform that collected personal information from the URL and that shared it without our knowledge with social media. We have taken immediate action to remediate this issue. The spokesperson said, without saying what action was taken, the spokesperson declined to comment further. When reached for comment, Facebook spokesperson Emil Vasquez provided a statement. We've been clear in our policies that advertisers should not send sensitive information to our people through our business tools. Doing so is against our policies, and we educate advertisers on properly setting up business tools to prevent this from occurring. Our system is designed to filter out potentially sensitive data it is able to detect. LinkedIn spokesperson Breonna Ruff said much to the same effect, noting that customer ad tools and agreements are clear and prohibit them from sharing sensitive data with us. Snap did not respond to a request for comment when contacted by TechCrunch. TechCrunch discovered in their testing that the USPS website shared the postal address of a logged-in USPS informed delivery customer with Meta, LinkedIn, and Snap. TechCrunch tested this by inspecting the network traffic using tools baked into most modern browsers. TechCrunch testing showed the data collecting code on USPS website was scraping the customer's address from the informed delivery landing page after customers logged in and sending it to the companies. The code also collected other data, such as information about the user's computer type and browser, which appeared as partly pseudonymized, essentially scrambled in a way that makes it more difficult for humans to know where data came from or who it relates to by using randomized identifiers in place of real customer names. But researchers have long warned that pseudonymized data can still be used to re-identify seemingly anonymous individuals. TechCrunch also found that tracking numbers entered into the USPS website were also shared with advertisers and tech companies, including Bing, Google, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Snap. Some in-transit tracking data was also shared, such as the real-world location of the mail in the postal system, even if the customer was not logged into the USPS website. USPS spokesperson declined to say if the Postal Service will ask the tech companies to delete the data that they collected. A spokesperson for the USPS Office of Inspector General, the federal watchdog that provides oversight of the Postal Service, did not comment at press time. USPS is the latest organization in recent years to curtail its use of web tracking code. In 2023, telehealth wellness startup Cerebral and alcohol recovery apps Tempest and Monument revealed they had shared their private health information, including assessments submitted by their users, with tech and advertising companies and had since removed the tracking code. In the same year, the Federal Trade Commission brought enforcement action against healthcare data against GoodRx, which agreed to pay $1.5 million for sharing health data of customers with advertisers and online therapy company BetterHelp, which was ordered to compensate patients to the tune of $7.8 million for also sharing their private health questionnaire responses. Now that's going to be interesting. Will the Federal Trade Commission bring enforcement action and penalties against the U.S. Postal Service? And in this case, when USPS was apprised of this situation, they knew nothing about it. There's finger pointing everywhere with the social media companies and the post office. Well, government at its best in the interest of customer service. Passwords disappear for millions of Windows users thanks to Google. 15 million users found themselves locked out of all their passwords for 18 hours thanks to a Google bug. A bug in Chrome version 127 caused passwords to vanish for around 15 million Windows users. The issue lasted for nearly 18 hours before being fixed. Users had to use a command line flag as a temporary fix, but the final solution required just a browser restart. Yes, turn it off and turn it on again. This incident highlights the risk of relying solely on browser-based password managers. It has not been a great month for tech giants. Earlier this month, the CrowdStrike bug brought many businesses to a complete standstill and left millions facing the blue screen of death, causing disruptions many are still recovering from following postponed flights and surgeries, to name just a few inconveniences. Well, not to be left out, Google had to cause its own chaos, according to this report from Forbes. Windows users clearly haven't suffered enough, and an estimated 15 million of them were locked out of their own passwords for nearly 18 hours from July 24th to July 25th due to a change in product behavior with Google Chrome. The specific problem affecting Windows users was with Google Password Manager. With the Chrome boasting more than 3 million users, there are a hell of a lot of people relying on this feature. The issue limited at least somewhat to the M127 version of the Chrome browser on Windows, prevented users from accessing previously stored passwords and render new passwords completely invisible. While limited to this specific update, That's still a huge chunk of users, which Forbes predict to have been around 15 million. At the time, there was a workaround, but not one most end users would be comfortable implementing, as it involved launching the browser with a command line flag. This issue, which has now been fixed, now simply requires a browser restart, but it took up to 18 hours to get it fixed. Google extended its apologies, of course they would, to customers, saying, "We apologize for the inconvenience the service disruption outage may have caused." Perhaps solely reliant on Google Password Manager alone for pretty much every single website isn't the brightest idea. If you are dependent on a password manager, it's probably best not to store everything in one and one alone, especially in this age of tech mishaps. Microsoft says the European Union rules make CrowdStrike outage possible. Macs do not have this problem. The recent global IT outage, in which a faulty update to cybersecurity company CrowdStrike software brought down millions of Windows PCs, caused billions of dollars worth of damage across a number of industries, including airline transport, retail, and banking. Mac devices, however, were not affected, as Apple Mac OS operating system does not grant third-party app makers kernel-level access, preventing the type of catastrophic error that resulted in the dreaded blue screen of death on Windows PCs. Now Microsoft is saying it wasn't able to put the same protections in place due to long-standing agreement with the European Commission. In a statement given to the Wall Street Journal, a Microsoft spokesperson said the company cannot legally wall off its operating system in the same way Apple does because of an understanding it reached with the European Commission following a complaint. This is referring to the 2009 agreement in which Microsoft pledged to give third-party security apps developers the same level of access to its Windows OS as Microsoft itself gets. In contrast, Apple took away kernel access from third-party developers back in 2019 when it launched Mac OS Catalina. The faulty CrowdStrike update was devastating for IT systems around the globe as it caused a systems crash on a multitude of Windows PCs. A fix could not easily be deployed as the systems would immediately crash again on reboot, causing a condition called reboot loop. In a letter to customers and partners, CrowdStrike CEO George Kurtz said it was taking steps to prevent anything like this from happening again. The question, however, is what steps should Microsoft take to make sure one small update to a third-party software, CrowdStrike or others, cannot wreak havoc on global IT infrastructure again? Astronauts stuck in space by malfunctioning Boeing spacecraft. Astronauts stuck in space by malfunctioning Boeing spacecraft can't return home for weeks. Retired U.S. Navy Captain Commander Barry Butch Wilmore and spacecraft pilot Sunita Sunny Williams were launched from Pad 41 at Cape Canaveral Space Force Station on Wednesday, June the 5th, 2024. Officials said two astronauts are stranded in space longer than their planned mission because their Boeing-built ride home is full of leaks and will have to spend at least a few more weeks aboard the International Space Station. Astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sunny Williams were meant to spend just 8 days in space following the launch aboard the Boeing Starliner, the maiden crewed voyage for the spacecraft. Once in space, astronauts found a series of concerning helium leaks and have been testing whether the ship can be used to return them to Earth. Two astronauts stranded in space will have to spend at least a few more weeks aboard the International Space Station. Now they're expected to stay in orbit until sometime in August. Steve Stitch, NASA Commercial Crew Program Manager, told reporters, "Before the astronauts can come home, NASA and Boeing experts said they need to complete a final set of tests for Starliner's thrusters scheduled for this weekend. Should the thruster test prove successful and the helium leaks continue to remain stable, NASA would schedule an agency review next week which would then set an official date for Wilmore and Williams' return. Stitch added, the prime intent is still to return Butch and Sonny aboard Starliner. Mark Nappy, manager of the Boeing Starliner program, said the company ultimately regrets announcing that Wilmore and Williams' mission would be 8 days, as the delays have garnered backlash against the troubled aerospace giant. Nappy said, my regret is that we didn't say we would stay up there until the mission is complete. But I'm very confident we have a good vehicle to bring the crew back. Stitch added that there are no current concerns about supplies dwindling aboard the ISS with two additional astronauts aboard, noting that Wilmore and Williams have remained positive and continue to enjoy the extended stay in space. NASA noted that should anything go wrong with the weekend test and Starliner proves too big a risk for a return trip, the agency has other backup methods for getting the astronauts home. The easiest method, Stitch said, is for Wilmore and Williams to hitch a ride on SpaceX Crew Dragon spaceship, the Boeing's rival, which recently ferried 4 astronauts to the ISS in March, normally carries 2 to 4 passengers at a time, but it can fit additional occupants if needed. The beauty of having Dragon and Starliner is that we have 2 different systems of transportation to the ISS, Stitch said. Someday, Starliner could be a backup to a Dragon mission. SpaceX has served as the sole commercial company approved to transport astronauts and cargo to the space station since 2020. Let's hope both of them can get back soon. Charter loses 393,000 video subscriptions in the second quarter. The cable giant led by CEO Chris Winfrey also shed 154,000 broadband customers after the end of government subsidies. Cable giant Charter Communications, with John Malone's Liberty Broadband as a major stakeholder, has continued to shed video subscribers. The company, led by CEO Chris Winfrey, revealed that it lost 393,000 residential pay TV subscribers in its latest quarter, compared with a loss of 189,000 customers in the year before period. Video revenue totaled $3.9 billion in the second quarter, down 7.7% year-on-year, as Charter ended the latest financial period with 13.3 million overall video customers, down 9.5% from a year earlier. Charter and Comcast, which similarly shed video customers amid a pivot by customers to streaming platforms, have rolled out their Xumo streaming platform to retain TV content subscribers. Winfrey, on a morning call with analysts, said video customers were making choices based on affordability. During the second quarter, Charter residential internet customers fell in number by 154,000, due mainly to the end of affordable connectivity program government subsidies to allow low-income households to save on monthly packages. Winfrey said Charter was working to retain internet subscribers where possible after they no longer receive an up to $30 price discount on their monthly internet package after the ACP program ended. The real question is the customer's ability to pay not just now, but over time. He added, as market churn and challenges in signing up new internet subscribers are likely going forward, as the loss of the ACP benefit impact is expected to flow through to the current financial quarter. For sure, there'll be more non-paid disconnects in the third quarter, Winfrey warned, without giving actual subscriber trend forecasts. Ultimately, this ACP impact is one time. That said, we're very focused on really isolating the ACP impact internally and evaluating our performance and retaining those customers because we want to keep them connected. Second quarter overall revenue rose 0.2% to $13.7 billion as increased residential mobile service. Charter added 557,000 residential and business mobile lines, and residential internet revenue in part offset lowered residential video revenue. charter said that we remain fully focused on driving customers' growth with a unique, high-quality product set that continues to evolve, creating long-term value for shareholders. Winfrey said in a statement ahead of the analyst call, as Wall Street eyes the rate of customer decline at the cable giant in the face of streaming competition and the loss of ACP subscribers. Charter's net income attributable to shareholder came to $1.23 billion, just up from a year earlier, $1.22 billion. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, technology, and yes, sometimes evolving technology. Drew reached out to me. Is it right to use artificial intelligence in our jobs? Okay, so there are a number of different thoughts on this front. I'm going to go with yes, but there are a lot of different things that come along with this. There's some certain baggage, and I'll get into that, and I'll explore some of that baggage along the way. For starters, let's go with one of the key things of why I say yes. Because everybody else, not everybody else, a lot of people are doing it. They are setting up some personal framework for themselves, and I have seen companies setting up frameworks, and you need to follow those. And I'll get into that here in a moment. But let's talk about some of those things that might really give you some pause, give you some concern as you are going through and utilizing something like ChatGPT or any one of the myriad of artificial intelligence programs that are out there, our large language models. First off, privacy and utilizing AI involves a lot of data collection. And this data collection happens typically, if you're in a company, it's happening within your network. But once you start to send this information, you go, hey, ChatGPT, process this information in this spreadsheet, left, right, forwards, backwards, and give me the result that I'm asking for. That information is no longer on your local computer network for your company, who you're working for. That data can be utilized by any number of people in that realm as it moves on out there. That information, look, any information that you put on the internet can be stored, saved, processed, spindled, mutilated, and utilized by bad guys. So with that risk of sensitive information being mishandled or exposed, you do not wish to expose your company to any of these kinds of data breaches. So you need to think very carefully about what you're doing. Now, with that, I will take a quick aside. Some companies have done some wheeling and dealing with ChatGPT and all of these different large language models, and they've said, hey, we want a custom one that keeps all of our information in-house. Some companies have set up their own AI servers, large language models, and they have set it up so that the server retains the information in-house. That may free you up from that privacy concern. Next up, let's talk about quality control. If you're using AI, that could mean that there is a dip in the quality of work. Okay, and how far is that dip? It can be pretty far. Unlike humans, AI lacks a lot of the intuition. It lacks the creativity that may make the difference. It may make some very bold claims in either direction. I have tinkered with AI, and I've asked it questions which it should know the answer, and it was completely wrong. It was something simple like, is AI sentient? And sometimes it says yes, and sometimes it says no. we are all fairly sure right now that it is not sentient. And we've seen some various mistakes along the way with AI. So let's go into who's accountable for those mistakes. When those mistakes happen, who is responsible? So if AI makes a blunder, you may have a hard time figuring out if there's a blunder. You may have a hard time figuring out where the fault lies, especially when you are the person who is accountable for the accuracy of that processing of the information. Last up, is this something that has to do with ethical decision making? Artificial intelligence lacks a moral compass. And when I say lacks, I mean completely, totally is void of a moral compass. It cannot make ethical decisions the same way that you or I can. And this could lead to a variety of different ethical dilemmas that you may have buried in the results that you have asked it to provide. Above all else, you need to go with where your superiors say, your corporate leadership, whatever they advise. Even if you use this, you also need to make sure that you are not passing along your work without attributing it to AI. Look, hey, I processed this using AI. AI did this, so I'm fairly sure I did my review. And this is the other thing. You need to review everything that it gives back to you. You need to make sure, go over it with a fine-tooth comb. Because, again, as I mentioned, the quality on it is not going to be perfect. AI messes up far more than you would ever expect. So, by all means, stay within those boundaries. Stay with where you're comfortable, because, look, you are on the hook for everything that you do, all of the work that you do, and you cannot blame any of the mistakes on AI. Everybody's just going to look at you like, really? So you did your work in 5 minutes, which takes everybody else 5 hours, and you're going to blame that on the computer, and you think you're going to keep your job after that? Yeah, that'll be rough. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. How to revive your broken USB flash drive? Need to recover data from an unformattable USB drive? USB drives are tiny, stick-like devices that are easy to travel with and simple to use. All you have to do is store your data on one, and you can now take that data with you. However, they can also have format errors that make them undeletable. Such situations, no doubt, are frustrating. Not does it result in lost data, but also because these errors can render the drive unusable. Recovering a seemingly unformattable USB drive is a challenge, but it's not impossible. With the right steps, this problem can be solved in most cases. Free special tools such as the HP USB Disk Storage Format Tool offer more formatting options than the Windows operating system. If a USB medium can no longer be formatted, this can have various causes, from simple software errors to more serious hardware problems. Before you write off the USB drive, you have several options at your disposal. First, you should check that the drive is correctly connected to the computer. Changing the USB port can sometimes help. If this doesn't help, the next step is to test the USB drive on another PC. This will ensure that the problem isn't related to a specific computer. If these simple solutions do not solve the problem, Windows Disk Management can help you. This will help you to recognize the drive and delete any existing partitions. This clears the way for repartitioning and formatting. You can initiate this process via the command prompt with administrative rights or via the graphical user interface of Disk Management. You can also use special software to restore USB drives. Such programs are designed to diagnose and fix common problems with the USB storage media. This also includes the recovery of unformattable drives. These tools offer advanced features that go beyond the standard Windows options. There's a good chance that they will be able to successfully restore the drive in many cases. Recommended free tools are Format USB or HP USB Disk Storage Format Tool. USB sticks are still often used today as portable data media. However, errors can sometimes mean that you can only use them to a limited extent or not at all. Despite these methods, it can happen that a USB drive is physically damaged and can no longer be repaired. In such cases, you will have to accept the fact that the data is irretrievably lost. The only way to avoid such losses is to regularly back up important data on different storage media or in the cloud. But before you give up on the USB stick for good, it's worth trying to recover the drive. With the right techniques and tools, the process is often successful, and then you can continue to use the USB drive as before. A history of HDDs and SDDs. Hard disk drives technology is relatively ancient in terms of computer history. The IBM 650 RAMAC hard drive from 1956 used a whopping total of 50 24-inch wide platters to hold a mere 3.75 megabytes of storage space. That's roughly the size of a single music track you might stream today, stored in the physical space that could hold two commercial refrigerators. The PC hard drive form factor was standardized at 5 1/4 inch in the early 1980s, with 3.5-inch desktop class and 2.5-inch notebook class drives coming soon after that. The internal cable interface has changed over the years from serial to IDE, now frequently called parallel ATA or PATA, to SCSI to serial ATA SATA. But each essentially does the same thing. Connect the hard drive to the PC's motherboard so your data can be shuttled to and fro. The 2.5 and the 3.5-inch drives are what survives today in modern internal hard disk drives, and both use SATA interfaces in almost all cases, at least on consumer computers. As for capacities, hard disk drives have grown from multiple megabytes to multiple terabytes, more than a millionfold increase, while retaining the same 2.5-inch and 3.5-inch physical sizes. The solid-state drive has a much shorter history, though its roots do reach several decades into the past. Technologies like bubble memory were briefly popular in the 1970s and 1980s. Those bubbles have long since burst, but current flash memory is a logical extension of the same idea, as it does not require constant power to retain the data you stored on it. The first primary drives we know as SSDs started appearing during the rise of so-called netbooks in the late 2000s. Capacities were tiny by today's standards. In 2007, the OLPC X01 used a 1 GB solid-state drive, while the ASUS EEEPC 700 series used a 2 GB solid-state drive as primary storage. The solid-state drive chips on these laptops were permanently soldered to the motherboard. As netbooks and other ultra-portable laptops became more capable, solid-state drives' capacities increased and eventually standardized on the 2.5-inch notebook form factor. This way, you could pop a 2.5-inch hard drive out of your laptop or desktop and replace it easily with solid-state drive, and manufacturers could design around just one kind of drive bay. In time, other more compact solid-state drive form factors emerged, like the mSATA or the mini PCIe SSD card and the M.2 solid-state drive format. M.2 has expanded rapidly through the laptop solid-state drive world, and today the solid-state drives that still uses the 2.5-inch form factor are primarily meant for upgrading desktop PCs and older laptops. What are the advantages and disadvantages of solid-state drives and hard disk drives? Both solid-state and hard drives do the same job. They boot your system and store your applications and personal files. However, each type of storage has its own unique traits. How do they differ, and why would you want to get one over the other? How expensive a solid-state drive versus a hard disk drive? Although they were once prohibitively costly, solid-state drives are no longer much more expensive than hard drives in terms of dollars per gigabyte. A 2-terabyte internal 3.5-inch hard drive costs around $60, while the cheapest 2.5-inch solid-state drive of the same capacity starts around $90. How roomy is an SSD versus an HDD in maximum and common capacities? Consumer solid-state drives come in capacities of up to 8 terabytes, but these are expensive. You're more likely to find 500 gigabytes or 1 terabyte units as primary drives in systems. While 500 gigabyte is considered a base root drive capacity for mainstream laptops these days, pricing concerns can push that down to 256 gigabytes for lower priced solid-state drive based systems. Users with extensive media collections who work in content creation will require even more, with 2-terabyte and 4-terabyte drives available in high-end systems. Meanwhile, consumer desktop PCs with a solid-state drive as a boot drive and one or more hard disk drives typically offers hard disk drives with much greater capacities than the boot solid-state drive. In this scenario, you could buy a desktop with a 1-terabyte solid-state drive, boot drive, and one or more 8-terabyte or 16-terabyte hard disk drive, secondary storage drives. For example, though you can get individual hard drives in capacities up to 22 terabytes. Well, how fast is a solid-state drive versus a hard disk drive? Speed is where solid-state really shines. A solid-state drive equipped PC will boot in less than a minute, often in seconds. Hard disk drives require time to speed up to operating specs and will continue to be slower than solid-state drives during everyday use, which is another reason why they are no longer used as boot drives. A PC or Mac with a solid-state drive boots faster, launches and runs apps faster, and transfer files faster. A secondary issue for this is fragmentation. Because of their rotary recording surfaces, hard drives work best with larger files laid down in contiguous blocks. That way, the drive head can start and end its read in one continuous motion. When hard drives start to fill up, bits of large drives end up scattered around the disk bladder, causing the drive to suffer from what's called fragmentation. While read-write algorithms have improved to the point that the effect is minimized, hard drives can still become fragmented to the point of affecting performance. Solid-state drives can't, however, because the lack of physical read head means data can be stored anywhere without penalty. This contributes to solid-state drives' inherently faster nature. To put it in number terms, a typical platter-based single hard drive won't exceed read-or-write speeds of 250 megabytes per second, whereas a basic SATA bus SSD will routinely peak at transfer rates twice that. Newer generation PCI Express-based solid-state drives, depending on the generation and number of PCI Express lanes supported, can be far faster. They can easily top 4 times the speed of the quickest platter drives, and the fast-becoming mainstream PCI Express Gen 4 drives can top out at 3,500 megabytes or even 7,000 megabytes per second, of course, depending on the model. Cutting-edge PCI Express 5.0 drives can exceed 5-figure transfer rates. They won't read and write at those peak speeds all the time, but as you can see, the comparison between the technologies is not even close. Well, how durable is a solid-state drive versus a hard disk drive? A solid-state drive has no moving parts, so it's more likely to keep the data safe if you drop your laptop bag or your system gets shaken while it's operating. Most hard drives park their read-write heads when the system is off, but when they're working, the heads fly over the drive platter at a distance of a few nanometers. Besides, even parking brakes have limits. If you're rough on your equipment, a solid-state drive is recommended. What are solid-state drive and hard disk drive form factors? Because hard disk drives rely on spinning platters, there is a limit to how small they can be manufactured. Years back, there was an initiative to make tiny 1.8-inch spinning hard drives, but that stalled out at about 320 gigabytes, and now, well, they're gone. The standard sizes today are 2.5-inch and 3.5-inch. The 2.5-inch size is meant for older laptops that have 2.5-inch drive bays, but they can also be mounted in desktop PC cases, as modern cases provide mounting points for both drive sizes. The 3.5-inch form factor is designed strictly for installation in desktop PCs. Their platters have a bigger radius and thus can hold more data at any given density versus a 2.5-inch drive. Solid-state drives can be inherently smaller since there's no platter, spindle, or motor to factor in, so they can continue to shrink as time goes on. As discussed, solid-state drives are available in 2.5-inch laptop drive sizes, but that's only for convenience in fitting within established drive bays. Most modern laptops come with a gumstick size M.2 SSD attached directly to the motherboard, and many modern desktop boards have multiple M.2 slots. Note though, in the case of some usually ultra-thin laptops, the solid-state drive NAND chips are mounted directly on the motherboard and are not upgradable or removable. Well, what about solid-state drive versus hard disk drive noise, power, and lifespan? Even the quietest hard drive will emit a bit of noise when it is in use. The drive platters spin, and the read arm ticks back and forth. Faster hard drives will tend to make more noise than slower ones. Solid-state drives make no noise at all. They're non-mechanical. Plus, a solid-state drive doesn't have to expend electricity spinning up a platter from a standstill. Consequently, none of the energy consumed by the solid-state drive is wasted as friction, rendering them more efficient. On a desktop or in a server, that will lead to lower energy bills. On a laptop, you can eke out more minutes or hours of battery life. Then there's the issue of longevity. Yes, solid-state drives indeed wear out over time. Each cell in a flash memory bank can be written to and erased a limited number of times. Measured by solid-state drive makers across the whole drive as a terabytes written or TBW rating. But thanks to TRIM technology that dynamically optimizes these read-write cycles, you're more likely to discard the system for obsolescence before they start running into read-write errors with a solid-state drive or the PC starts decommissioning overused cells. If you're worried, several tools can tell you if you're approaching the drive's rated end of life. Eventually, hard drives will wear out from constant use, as since they use physical recording methods and motors. Longevity is a wash when it's separated from travel and ruggedness concerns. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
I am Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty,
I've been to another world, Ben.
You've been to another world?
Well, to other world,
that's
anyway.
That sounds rather spaced out. Yeah, I mean, and you know, although you don't really fit into any of that hippie category, you were one of the straight laced guys at that time of year.
I wouldn't count on it. I might have been a spy at the time.
There you go.
Larry O'Connor's company, Otherworld Computing.
Yes, yes.
Has, and I thought this was very clever. It's a very skinny, long stick. Looks like a kind of half of a silver, the pepperoni stick, maybe. It's a USB 3.2 drive with two connectors.
Okay.
One of them's a USB-C connector. One of them is USB-A. Okay. USB-C connector has a cap over it. When you plug it into USB-C, more on that in a second, the USB-A connector flips, thanks to a kind of slip-and-slide pivot holding it, to place itself in a mating internal connection, leaving the pivoting side's LED and cap visible.
Mm-hmm.
So when using the USB-A connector, the LED is either hidden inside or visible because you didn't pivot it into being tucked away. Now, they offer some online tips on how to make it compatible with more than one operating system's drive formatting. I was disappointed that they didn't use a long-nose USB-C connector. As a result, the body is too wide to plug into my Pixel phone. And even when I take the case off the phone, well, they suggest buying a USB extension cord, which, you know, kind of makes having an all-in-one drive lost cause. Anyway, suddenly a small totable solution becomes a carry kit. So figure out what's handy for you. The 1 terabyte model they sent me is about $170 on Amazon.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. But now, is this all stainless steel here or what? I mean, is this?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes, and
or aluminum or something. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it looks elegant and it looks rugged, and I have no doubt it'll last until a terabyte's no longer a significant amount of anything.
Sure, sure.
Now, you may wonder what I'm going to do while I'm moving all that data onto this drive.
Yeah, how long is it going to take?
A few minutes anyway,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I also got an Agormia GCM4210 4-shot steam espresso maker.
Oh, what a great time to make it. Aren't we getting fancy with our coffee today? Yes.
It, you know, makes espresso or a cappuccino with steamed milk or latte with milk froth. How many are you making? The glass carafe on this thing has measure marks for the water. There's a simple control knob for steam.
Okay.
Turn the brew on or off. The frothing wand nozzle comes with a removable cover. The brew head locks into place with indexing symbols for where the portafilter, in English, the filter retainer, where its handle points when you add or remove it. So, oh, by the way, the filter also has marks for both the grounds, grounds, and there's a measuring scoop that's included in the kit. So you take your extra dark coffee, you decide how much you're making, you put the water in, you put the coffee in, turn the knob or not, get the thing in the porta-porta or not, put your cup underneath, and be ready to be energized. This is from Gormia, it's really a lovely cup. I can't tell you how.
Yeah, yeah.
Electrified my pace got after drinking. Testing was an accelerant.
I remember years ago, because it's over 20 years that I've been allergic to coffee, but I do remember the nice kick that espresso would do on you.
Well, you've been allergic to coffee simply because you're so addicted to being lazy.
Oh, brutal.
Don't
tell my boss. Don't tell my boss. She's in the other room and she's.
Benjamin Rockwell is the hardest working guy in an easy chair.
Yeah, my wife would agree with that. Yeah. Well, AK, my boss. Yeah.
The boss, indeed. Yeah, we know what's in on that. I have to say, the mix of things I've been seeing lately is so broad and so unexpected. Uh-huh. I'm getting in decking for outdoors. I'm getting in new kinds of lights that I have no place to put, so I'll just light them up to show that they work and figure it out from there. I'm good. What's behind me? Oh, my.
There is a bit of a disaster zone back there.
Oh, it's getting worse and worse. I think if I get it to be big enough, I can get it to eat me.
So we've got about a minute left. How long does it take to copy data on that OWC Envoy? I mean, reference going and making some cappuccino, but, I mean, it's a terabyte drive. You're not going to typically copy a terabyte worth of data.
I expected 45 minutes, and I really can't tell you how much data I put over. It was a big chunk of what I had on OneDrive, so I could make it portable. Mm-hmm, very well. Yeah. And it was done in about 4.5 minutes. So,
okay,
something there is speedy.
That's kind of nice.
USB 3.2. Now, I think that only happens at a USB-C connection. I don't think it's going to be quite as fast at USB-A.
Probably not. Probably nowhere near it. All right. So, as for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that is the wonderful voice of Marty Winston.
The voice is wonderful. I make no claims for self.
There you go. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that is Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 2nd, 2024. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, August the 6th, 2024. Meeting time is 7 p.m. In-person general meetings are back. Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York, zip code 10583. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation, ATSC 3.0, The Next Generation of Television. Thursday, August the 8th, 2024, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 9th, 2024, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, August the 13th, 2024. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, August the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.